the method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If you're listening to Unsound Methods for the first time, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, technique and approach. So in this month's episode, we have Hamid Ismailov, the Uzbek writer.
Emigre, would you say?
Yeah. nice opportunity to use that word.
We had a fascinating chat with Hamid about his process, and he's written numerous novels and short stories. He writes in Russian, Uzbek and English. It's interesting to hear how his process works, so combining the lo-fi and the high technology, that he only writes longhand and then he reads it into the computer using voice recognition software to get the tonality, which I think is quite an interesting approach. I've not tried voice recognition software for years and it didn't really work, but I think it's a lot better these days.
Sounds like it's moved on a lot, doesn't it? Yeah. And it was also fascinating to speak to him about the effect of the various languages. I mean, he writes in at least three languages. We spoke about three he writes in. And the effect they have and the impossibility, really, of translating things accurately. And also the kind of political situation. He's a writer whose work is banned in Uzbekistan. And I think if you're writing in Uzbek, that's quite a lot of your target market. And I don't know about the adjacent countries where they do speak Uzbek, whether his work's controlled there or not.
But. Yeah, I don't know. I guess he's banned as well. You were saying he's in the airport.
Persona non grata in Uzbekistan.
Here is our conversation with Hamid.
Thank you for coming in to join us. You're stopping off on the way to the Faversham Literature Festival, and you're promoting is it a collection of short stories or is it a novel?
No, it's a full-scale novel, which is called Of Strangers and Bees. And it tells the story of an ancient Central Asian polymath, Avicenna, who was the father of the surgery, who was the father of mathematics, father of many things, you know, algorithms and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So that's focusing on another historical figure. It seems obviously more familiar with The Devil's Dance, which has at least two or three historical writers and sort of poets involved in it. So is the sort of historical aspect and the sort of research side a very important part of your writing for you?
Partly, maybe, because some of my writing is completely about the modern times of Uzbekistan or of Central Asia. But partly because now, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the traditions of newly created countries of those stans, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, it's very important, the tradition, and the identity, the search for the identity is quite an important. So history becomes the part of the discourse, of the narrative, and people are thinking and re-examining their histories, sort of searching for their identity, searching for the traditions to which they belong.
And is that a conscious goal in your writing to sort of work on the identity of?
In a way, but because I'm writing not so much the concepts, but the human characters. Because the human characters which I'm describing are involved in a sort of, modern thinking, so it becomes part of their thinking as well. Mm-hmm. Not forcefully, but sort of aesthetically, through the literature, through the arts,
And is that a kind of politically contested ground, what the identity means to, say, Uzbeks?
It is, because the governments, all the governments of Central Asia, they are creating, their vision of the history, in which, for example, every nation is the sort of, you know, the mightiest in the past, you know, the glorious in the past. So if you read the Kazakh history of nowadays, everything appears to sort of originate from Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. If you read the Uzbek, let's say, history, or the version of the history which the government or the authorities suggest. So all the great things are coming from Uzbeks, yeah? And they've sort of given to the world, you know, the best of the best, yeah? For example, I very often bring an example of the sculpture in the middle of the Tashkent, of the capital of Uzbekistan. There is a sculpture of a globe with one country on it. And guess which one, yeah? So, therefore, their version of the history should be contested, yeah? And what I'm trying to do, to show the historical figures as the characters, as the humans who were living at that time and possibly were facing the same challenges which we are facing now. For example, you know, rationality against the irrationality, religion and the society. So there are lots of issues which they're facing exactly in the same manner as we are facing now.
And, so, and when you come to start a new project, is it the ideas and those issues that are the primary driver? I mean, do you start with the tension between some of those topics, like nationality and history, or do you start with a specific character and then through that character the issues emerge naturally?
It's mostly a character, a character. But when I start to look into the character, it consists of all of that, of that. Usually the first impulse, I would like to depict the character, for example.
And how do you come across the character? How do you decide this character is going to be the basis of a novel? And how do you decide that's an interesting character, but I'll maybe come back to them, but they're not, I'm not going to start writing a novel about this. But what's the moment when you realize, I'm beginning to write a novel about this
person? Depends. I'll give you a couple of examples. One of the examples is the book which is called The Dead Lake. Yeah, it became quite famous. It was included into the school curriculum in this country. It tells the story of a young man, of 28 years old, who stayed, you know, in the form, in the shape of 10-year-old boy because of the, of him living next to the nuclear site where the Soviets were exploding, you know, the nuclear bombs 468 times, yeah? And they were living as a byproduct there. And this is a story of a boy who was in love with a girl, but he stopped to grow when he was 10, 12, and she continued to grow, you know. It's a kind of parable, you know, of a person left behind in the Soviet time, like an exponent of, of this attempt to become equal to the United States, a symbol of the modernity versus tradition, so all of that. That image of a boy stayed with me for 25 years. You know,
can you remember the first time you came across
this boy? I met this boy in the train, and it stayed with me for 25 years. I didn't know what to do with him, how to sort of describe him, but there was something which clicked all of a sudden, and I decided to write this boy. And all of the what I'm saying now, the concepts of the Third World War, of the arms race, of the ecology, of the modernity versus the traditions, all of that then came after.
But you'd spent within that 25-year period, those thoughts had occurred to you. Do you take any notes? Like, is it something you might, 10 years late after meeting the boy, write a note about, that could have a parallel with the tension between modernity and history or something.
Sometimes I take the notes. Sometimes it comes out of nothing. Mm. For example, another novel, which is called The Underground, is telling the story, once again, of a boy, because I was interested in entrance point to life and the exit point of life. Initially, I was, I've noticed myself that I was writing about children, boys or girls, and old people. Because in the Soviet Union, the sort of, you know, the middle age was reduced to nothing. There were functions, you know, what I've seen around me, there were functions. And the humanity was either in children or in old people, you know, when there is nothing to lose, basically. In the beginning, there is nothing to lose, and at the end, there is nothing to lose. But otherwise, you are a sort of function of the society, And this half-black boy who lived in Moscow during the, you know, late years of the Soviet Union, I'm telling the story of the sort of breakup of the Soviet Union through this character, half-black boy who was born during the Moscow Olympics in 1980. His father was a Ghanaian sportsman, and his mother was a local prostitute, And the story is about this boy. But boy came as a secondary thing because all my life I wanted to write something about Moscow underground, which is one of the most beautiful undergrounds in the world. I lived in Moscow for 8 years, and I had a mental map of the Moscow thanks to the underground. I never sort of walked, on the ground. All my trips were underground, and every station had some meaning for me. I met my wife. Here I could made friends with someone, and so on and so forth. And I wanted to write this feeling of love to Moscow and to its underground, the underground life of Moscow.
And do you remember when that novel became apparent that you were going to write it as a novel?
Yes. I was in Moscow in my flat, which I left for 10 years. I came back to Moscow, and as if nothing has changed, you know, in these 10 years while I was in London, The snow was the same. It was a sleepless night, you know, the solitude was the same, and it clicked immediately. That is the sort of novel. And then the character came as a secondary thing. Mm. So it depends, you know, because every novel depends either from character or feeling or something. But then, like a snowball, you are sort of gathering more and more and more and more when it falls into a shape.
And did you have any notes? So you were in London for 10 years away from Moscow. During that 10-year period, did you write notes about the Moscow underground,
or you
put it out of your mind?
It's in mind, mostly in mind. You know?
And when you came to start writing the novel, were you relying on any notes particularly, or is note-taking and research something you do consciously, or it's just...
I used to do, not anymore. You know, what I do regularly, though, in my age now, maybe last 20, 25 years, I write down every night dream of mine. So, which helps me with the storytelling techniques as well. Yeah. But in my youth and sort of, maturity years, I used to have a diary as well, to write a diary. So, sometimes I use those notes, you know, they are giving me the feeling of that time. For example, one of the funny examples is, how we used to communicate the news at that time. For example, somewhere in far away place, someone died. Now we immediately call, and mobile is with us, so we immediately know. But I was facing a challenge, how the person should be sort of, informed about the death of another person in 1980, And I looked at my notes, which were describing the process. How did I get the news about something,
Yeah, because I guess a lot, having worked in news, you worked for the BBC World Service, and you would have been taking notes about the current affairs of the day,
yes,
as part of your day,
yes,
job. So
yes,
they naturally were taking the
yes notes. Yes. Though my work in journalism gave me lots of sort of unexpected things, which then I started to apply to literature. You know, in your youth, you are sort of, you know, excessive in your writing.
Hmm.
You know, because you would love to describe everything, you know, with hundreds of words, you know, because you've got the palette, yeah, of colors in your language, and you would love to use all colors of your language. But what journalism taught me, you can tell the story, you know, much sort of straightforward in a shorter way as well, you know, 3 minutes talk or 1 minute dispatch, for example, you know. So I started to be more economical.
Yeah. Was that in the sort of drafting, like, do you redraft extensively, or Do you find now, just through the years of that practice of being more economical, that you just naturally don't have much that you need to cut when you get to the end of?
So my process of writing consists of, first of all, I sort of use handwriting, yeah? So I'm still handwriting writer, because I think that sort of typing is completely different to handwriting. Mm. Handwriting is continuous, yeah? And it's a flow rather than an act of striking the key, yeah? Mm. So as a flow of thought, it gives me sort of, you know, continuity writing. Mm. Whereas I'm typing, I know that I'm, you know, subliminally thinking, am I striking at the right the character or whatever? It's a sort of, you know, it's... Mm. Discrete thing, basically. So therefore, handwriting is very important for me. Then what I'm doing nowadays, usually I used to give it to the typist, yeah? But now there are sort of gadgets when you can dictate, yeah? While dictating, I'm listening to the tone.
Mm.
Am I right in the tone, in the tonality of the of this flow, yeah, of this prose?
Is that would you write a complete novel in by hand?
And yes.
You wouldn't read it. So you use like software that voice recognition to read it into the computer.
Yeah, no, I am reading my handwriting into the computer,
yeah,
and computer sort of textualize it. Yeah,
but do you do that process of reading it into the computer? Is that at the end of a day's writing, or is that at the end of
At the end of the days of writing, when everything is done already.
Okay, so the end of the total end of the novel, you wouldn't spend the day writing and then in the evening read it in?
No. But usually I do the whole, the whole, for example, you know, novel, when it's ready, then I'll start to read it, into the computer. While reading, I'm once again editing it as well, you know, where I feel a sort of wrong intonation. Intonation is very important. Now, because of some problems with my sort of, you know, eyesight, I'm listening more to the novels rather than reading. And it's a completely different experience, because you feel the sort of, you know, the tonality of the thing. The intonations of the thing. And sometimes it's apparently much more subtle way to understand the novel, you know, because of that. Because the humanity has got, you know, thousands of years of listening rather than reading, We are much more sort of equipped for listening than to reading. That is very important for me as well as a writer. So I'm listening to what I wrote. If there is some wrong intonation, I'm trying to sort of, you know, polish it. Then I'm rereading it as a sort of, you know, the whole novel.
Just on a technical note, in terms of reading it in, it's not something I've much experience using the voice recognition of the computer. When you're editing it in that process, so you have a paragraph that you've written by hand, and you start reading it, and halfway through you think, this is not working. How practically do you edit it? Do you then go to the computer type?
Go to the computer, yeah. Go to the computer and type and read once again that version. Yeah. If I like it by my ear, so then it stays there.
Yeah. So you read it until you find one that is right, and then continue on to the next.
Other paragraph. People I know, for example, a friend of mine who is a translator, a wonderful translator, Robert Chandler, he reads everything he translates to his wife.
Hmm.
And wife listens, you know, and gives the sort of, you know, immediate reaction. It works, it doesn't work. But generally, I think that the listening is extremely important for conveying your thoughts, conveying your writing.
Did you used to read it out loud just by yourself, not into a computer prior to the software?
No. But I used to sort of, you know, while typing, for example, sort of, you know, read not out loud, but to myself. But when I discovered this technique, you know, reading out loud, it helped me enormously.
And do you
think it's improved the quality of my text?
That's what I was going to ask. Do you think? Yeah. And do you think it's had any changes on the sort of sentence structure and the sort of weight?
In a way.
Right.
What I discovered, for example, my writing before listening, was much more dense. You know, I tried to put everything into one sentence. Yeah, all pants, all jokes into one sentence. Sort of, it was too dense, you know, as a writing. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it's more organic. It's more sort of, you know, humane. Yeah. And more emotional, maybe.
And what are you writing in Uzbek? Or which language do you write in?
I write in Uzbek. When I tie writing in Uzbek, I write in Russian. When I tie writing in both of them, I write in English, something.
Your sort of preference, if you were just to start a novel, or do you sometimes write in different languages?
It comes with the language.
Right.
It comes with the language.
Is the entire novel in one language? Yeah. You wouldn't write the first chapter in Russian and then...
No. It comes with the language. Yeah.
I mean, that must have really interesting implications on how you write. I don't know much about Turkic languages, but I mean, there must be something about the sentence structure there that's going to be different to a Slavic language or a Germanic language.
Turkic languages are notoriously I don't want to use this word totalitarian, but they are sort of, you know, wholesome, let's say, because every sentence ends with a verb. So subject goes first, object is the second, and the verb comes at the end. So until you sort of put the verb, you don't know, is it a future tense, is it the past tense, is it conditional or whatever, you know? So you have to be patient. One thing. Secondly, you have to wait to the end of the sentence in order to make sense of it.
And conceptually, could a sentence be quite long? I mean, could you make a sentence that was 3 pages long?
A novel, we in a sentence. Yeah, now it's very popular among the writers to write a novel in one sentence.
a twist at the end when you reveal what the
that would be too suspensive, you know, in Uzbek. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure for your... translate. I mean, you other people translate your work, or the English work that I've seen. So, do you work quite closely with them, or do you?
I spent 20-25 years of my life translating, you know, books from different languages into different. And the more you know about the languages, the more you understand that they are sort of incomparable. Yes, these are the different ways of describing the world. Completely different. For example, I told you about the nature of Uzbek, yeah? So, every sentence ends with the verb, yeah? And imagine sort of, you know, the construction with the bricks, you know, and the connection between the bricks, yeah? So, the bricks which you are connecting is, in my case, verb versus noun, yeah? Mm-hmm. Because every sentence ends with the verb, but starts with the noun. Yeah. So this connection is essential in Uzbek. But in English, you could do whatever you want. Yeah. So the connection immediately breaks up. Yeah. Of the sentence with the sentence. It's a completely different structure in a way, you see. What you were thinking, what you were sort of subtly settling down or setting down, yeah, immediately breaks up, yeah. And therefore, what I do usually, if they ask me for sort of explanation or help, I'm helping. If not, so it's carte blanche, you know, for them, for the translators, because they are recreating the thing, yeah? They are adopting it for their mentality, for their language, for their context. So
I mean, I suppose it's, I'm always tempted to see a translation as just another work of art that's got
absolutely.
Its genesis in an absolutely. Existing one, but it's not.
Yes,
The idea that you can have a faithful translation.
No. What I'm saying usually, it's other, you're taking, for example, a metaphor of a plant. Yeah. So you're replanting plant which from Central Asia, let's say, to the English soil, basically. Yeah. Will it come, will it grow up? And what's the connection of this plant with other plants in your garden? That is the, your garden is completely different to Central Asian garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there another element in terms of the connotations for you? You're writing in different languages. And I mean, I guess Russian and Uzbek are, where they sit within Uzbek society has changed a lot. I mean, with the dismantling of the Soviet Union, the role of Russian, I imagine, is quite different than when you were growing up. And when you like write in Russian, does that have certain connotations of
absolutely.
What it
means? Absolutely. But that is a sort of, you know, so interesting area of to think, the sort of, you know, connections and context and sort of background of the things. Why, for example, some books from Uzbek are more popular, my, for example, books are more popular in English than in Russian.
Mm.
Because, you know, it goes even further, for example, to the mentality of people. Yeah. What I discover in this country, you know, that Uzbekistan is like this country has got the island, the mentality, you know, it's an island in the continent because you've got the sort of landlocked country which borders other landlocked countries. It's the only landlocked country, double landlocked country. Mm-hmm. And from all sides, you've got either mountains or you've got the deserts, you know. So now it's not a problem. But historically, it was a problem. Yeah, you couldn't escape the place. Yeah, you should have stayed there. And it created an island mentality. Yeah. And plus the sort of, you know, the court culture, the etiquette, which is very strong, for example, in English culture as well. Yeah, the court culture, the etiquette, the hierarchy, and so on and so forth. So lots of sort of, you know, things which are making, let's say, Japanese, British people, or Uzbeks are quite similar historically in a way. And therefore, some of the Uzbek, for example, the Devil Dance, yeah, which tells the story of the court, which tells the story of, you know, of a writer in prison, and so on and so forth, became much more popular in English than in Russian.
Mm. Is that because it maybe has some uncomfortable truths to tell about where people disappear to? I imagine if people have sort of long memories and lived through Soviet times, where maybe being a writer was a much more dangerous occupation than it is in contemporary Britain at the moment.
Maybe, but there are things which are sort of, you know, echoing much better for one culture than to another culture, yeah? And it's a fascinating topic to discuss. Yeah, why, for example, Murakami has became sort of, you know, so popular in the Western literatures, for example. Yeah, not so much maybe in his own as abroad, for example. It's a fascinating issue to discuss.
That isn't. I wonder what the. I mean, some of it will be luck about which publisher takes it on and the exposure it gets. But that is interesting about
it
why
is.
Some things really
it is.
Translate.
It is, yeah.
And it's interesting. Earlier you said Uzbek was, well, you were about to say authoritarian, and then you said wholesome. But for you, in your mind, how is Russian is Uzbek more associated with that sort of authoritarian hierarchical society than Russia? Because for me, not I've never been to Uzbekistan, but I'd imagine the Soviet era and Russian was kind of a top-down language that was forced on people to an extent, whereas Uzbek was a sort of familiar family oriented, or the language that people would speak in their family, so it might be more familiar, and the Russian would seem more authoritarian. But yeah, you were saying the Uzbek was, had this element of authoritarianism from, I guess, the history of the society. Like, how do those two kind of play in your mind now, and how growing up were the two kind of related to each other? Was one something you spoke at home and
Yeah. The language is just one part of the mentality, isn't it? So there are sort of, you know, the histories behind the people, there are sort of, you know, traditions behind the people, everything. Language is just a part. So, but language is a very important part. Yeah. And for example, during the Soviet time, I tried to find a single novel which was written against the Soviet authorities or whatever in Uzbek, apart from those people who were killed for that, during the Stalinian period, the characters from The Devil's Dance, for example. And I failed to find. I couldn't find. There was just one maybe novella. Yeah. Whereas in Russian, you've got plenty of writing which was sort of, you know, written, you know, for themselves or hidden or whatever, but was against the Russian occupation. Here you can feel the sort of, you know, the zeal for freedom in Russian mentality more than in Uzbek mentality. Yeah.
And do you think that was from coming from the society rather than just the situation
from language
on the ground?
And from the society. Language is a reflection of the society as well. And at the same time is a tool which in a way sort of, you know, runs the society as well.
That's really interesting, the sort of chicken and egg thing
about the language.
Do society, do languages grow from the society that has it, or the society shaped by the language that
Fascinating, for example, you know, findings of the Turkic languages, let's say, they are agglutinative. It means that you can extend the word with lots of affixes, For example, ish is a work, ishchi is a worker, ishchilar is workers, like in English. So you are adding and the word is changing. Ishchilarda, those at the workers. Ishchilardagi, the things which are with the workers. Ishchilardagidan, from those which are of the workers. You can extend sort of enormously one word, How do I explain? It was a nomadic society. You know, the Turks, the Turkic people were nomads, for millennia. And apparently, while sitting on the horse, you have to pass the information in a sort of, you know, in a the dense manner. Say one word and everything is understandable, you know, rather than a sedentary people, you know, having a luxury of time to explain each other, you know, with lots of words. You know, maybe that is the way how the language was formed. Maybe there are different other sort of processes. But what I'm trying to say here, language is the forming tool of the consciousness.
And what's your perspective on English, having worked in English now, in comparison, is it?
Yeah, in comparison, English is why it became a sort of global language. Because of flexibilities, because of its flexibility, because it's of its seemingly simpleness. With English, the more you know, the less you know, in fact, you know. But you can sort of manage with, you know, 400 English words. Yeah? You can manage. Whereas, for example, Russian has got lots of, you know, inclinations, declinations, exclusions. The grammar is overloaded, you know. It's very difficult to cope with the grammar. English has got kind of redundant grammar, you know. It's quite straightforward. Therefore, it became one of the global languages.
So again, that's interesting about whether...
Because I guess that's in like contrast to the sort of traditional... English, as you're saying, the sort of hierarchical society, and it has been traditionally quite non-flexible in certain ways, whereas the language...
was much more flexible.
It was flexible.
Yes, because maybe, once again, it's a fascinating topic, isn't it? Maybe it became sort of, you know, so unregulated and flexible... because of the empire, maybe, you know, because so many people spoke language, English language, and they've sort of, you know, moved language, shaped language in all forms, that it became so flexible, maybe.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there must be some element of that. It would be interesting to compare how, I don't know, in the 14th century, how in Britain people approached language
and was regulated,
how much freedom there was to
to change
to change and play around with grammar and that type of thing, whether it was a lot more strict than it is today. Because I think it is generally you're used to understanding and speaking English in all kinds of formats and ways.
Now we easily sort of adopt, let's say, the Caribbean words, for example, English words, bra or whatever. They easily adapt and it becomes a mainstream language as well, But in the 14th century, maybe, you know, it was completely different. There is English and English, for example. There is English of Nabokov, for example. Highbrow English when he tries to be more English than English.
And when it comes to your writing, do you start in a particular language and you always continue in that? Or do you sort of maybe start writing a piece and think, this isn't working, and switch to another language to try? Or is it always a kind of apparent from the very beginning what language you're going to approach it in?
You know, generally what happens to me, I always have 3, 4, 5 projects in my head. Which I wanted to write or want to write at a given moment, And I choose out of them. Sometimes, you know, I start, as you are saying, and it doesn't go. For example, there is a book in Uzbek, which I'm writing, you know, already maybe 25 years, never finished, you know. I'm still in the process, you know. I didn't find the shape for this thing. I know the idea of this book, but I couldn't find the shape for that. So rather than sort of waiting when the shape comes to my mind, I would rather write something which I could already sort of shaped in my mind, you know? So it depends on the circumstances.
And can it, like you mentioned sort of books that have like gestation periods of sort of decades. Do you ever sort of have an idea and start working on the next day and 2 months later you've finished it? Or do you tend to find that period of contemplation and thinking about the novel and the characters and the themes just naturally takes years to...
Now I've got a routine. I've got a routine. It starts, I'm starting to write, my writing season starts with the clock change. October-ish, because the nights are long, sometimes September-ish, but autumn time. So I start in the autumn time, and then it follows through all these dark days, you know, till April maybe, when I usually finish my novels or novellas. Sometimes it takes 2 years, 3 years, some of the novels. But the writing season is, let's say, October, April. The rest is either I'm writing short stories or thinking through next project, preparatory work. But preparatory work is sort of, you know, it's perennial. So you are thinking constantly about your next project.
You're not working away taking notes from April till September. Then.
No, I'm writing. And when after it comes... the work, for example, if I'm working at that time, so day, the, after the day work, I'm coming at home. Now my children are done, you know, so I'm sitting, let's say, at 8 o'clock until 10, 11, sort of, you know, my time is blocked and I'm writing.
Mm. That's every day?
Every day.
Right.
Including Saturdays and Sundays, yeah.
And then you consciously, when it comes around to April... Even if, I mean, if you're in the flow,
usually it's a finish.
It just happens to happens to. Right, I see.
Sometimes I finish in February, you know. Sometimes I finish in March. Sometimes the latest April. If I haven't finished, for example, in April, yeah. So it stays for the next season. Mm-hmm. Though I broke this promise, and this last summer I was writing. Yeah, I broke this promise because I was so inside of the thing, you know. I wanted to finish it off. And it was a sort of, you know, year-long project. Mm-hmm. So from October to October.
And that writing time, sort of in the evenings as well, you're writing longhand. Are you using a computer to do any research? Do you check facts while you're going along?
Yes, if I need, computer is next to my writing, but sort of switched off in a way, or in standby position,
rather than... Rather than going down the rabbit hole of the internet.
No.
8 days later, I haven't written anything.
Do you have any sort of... target of how much you want to write per day, or do you, I mean, some days you might write two words.
It, you know, if it's interesting, so I'm writing sort of more. If it's not interesting, I would rather stop, you know, and think through.
And do you go back, do you sort of not edit, but do you sort of discard work as you're going along? Do you sort of spend a week writing something and then at the end of the week think, no, actually that's not what should have happened, I'm going to discard that week and go back to the start of chapter two and begin again? Or do you kind of just go from the beginning to the end of the novel and you get what it...
I told you about the underground, yeah? It came, you know, I was in Moscow this night. It's snowing, it's lonely, so nothing has happened, over 10 years. So I've got the idea. I'm coming back to London. It's December-ish or November-ish, I'm coming back to London and I'm starting to write. I am writing hectically, sort of frantically, 50 pages. But all of a sudden, I realized that it reminds me one of my works, you know, previous works. And I hate when it reminds my previous work, anything. I would like everything afresh, you know, characters, style, tonality, so everything, you know. And I'm feeling that I'm repeating myself. There was this tone somewhere. I'm stopping, I'm tearing apart, you know, the 50 pages, and I'm still thinking, you know, and I'm changing the character from a girl to a boy. And all of a sudden it clicks, new tone, new character, new writing. And I am sort of, you know, on the course to write.
Mm-hmm. And is that normally at the sort of beginning stage? Like you were starting writing there, you wrote the first 50 pages and then stopped. Do you ever sort of get 200 pages in and feel the last, from 150 to 200, I need to change, but the first 150 are okay? Or is it normally in the very... beginnings of a novel that you have that struggle to find the voice or the
you know, when you're set up as I'm set up, as a writer, when you don't want to repeat yourself and when you're always breaking the rules of writing, of correct writing, because you know the rules of correct writing, but you don't want to write the correct writing. You are always breaking yourself, for something new, to explore yourself, to explore your writing, to explore characters. You always have the feeling, either it's the biggest fluke, you know, or it's something completely new. It's always the same feeling, you know. Maybe I failed here, you know, as a novelist. Always the same feeling. Either I failed or I achieved something completely new. So that feeling gives you sort of, you know, confidence in a way, confidence. Okay, if I failed, so I failed, yeah? But usually, I mean, this kind of writing gives much more gratifying results than, you know, when you are feeling absolutely sort of, you know, confident that you've written something of genius, yeah? Mm-hmm. So this feeling with the new thing, the latest thing, I'm saying to my wife, either it's the greatest fluke in my life, you know, or something completely, completely new and different.
Yeah. And at what stage are you at with the new thing that you've been working on?
I finished.
Okay, so it's all...
Yeah, I finished. Right. I finished. But I'm not sure, you know, 100%. I did, you know, when I'm satisfied, when I did, for example, you know, at least 80% of what I wanted to do, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not 100% perfectionist because it's impossible to do. Yeah,
I mean, 80% sounds really good to me.
Yeah, it was my son who taught me. You know, he he was born in this country and he went to look at the sort of, you know, to British schools and so on and so forth. So he inbuilt in my mind, you know, the concept of not to be sort of too clever by half. You know, mm-hmm. So 80% is a good result, you know, because we were brought up in the Soviet Union to get 100%, you know, 110% or 120%, you know, whatever the price is. But thanks to this country, I've got this now, the concept of 80 is good.
I think we need to use that as marketing ourselves now to the rest of the world. You know, in Britain, 80% is fine.
Yes.
It's our new brand.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the political aspect to your writing and the situation in Uzbekistan, because I'm not sure if it's still the case, but am I right in thinking that your works were previously unavailable or...?
No, it's available but banned.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Because
it's not so available.
Because of the internet, you know, you can't stop.
But yeah? it's still banned.
Banned, yeah, yeah. Officially banned.
Why? What's the reason for that?
I have no idea, you know. Politically, I might think of a couple of things. For example, when I was critical at the BBC, for example, about the steps of the government, for example, how the new president came to power anti-constitutionally. Yeah, maybe that is the sort of, you know, the thing why I'm not allowed back to Uzbekistan. But
you're not allowed?
No, no, I was in Uzbekistan in 2017 at the airport, you know, and was kicked out of the country, deported to Turkey.
Right.
Yes. So maybe because I was critical of the sort of, you know, of the new power coming to power, of the new authorities coming to power. Maybe. I can guess. Mm-hmm. But as for writing, it's not, you know, directly political. It's not a manifesto against the, you know, government or with the calls to overthrow or whatever. These are the normal novels, which are exploring the characters, the people. But with the years, I started to understand that any honest writing is subversive, you know, because the governments, they are trying to sell their view of the society, you know, how great is the Uzbek society now, how great is the future of Uzbekistan. But when you are showing an old man, yeah, who is migrating to Russia to look after his children there, yeah, and his children are killed by the skinheads, let's say, and he is left there to, you know, to roam the streets and to beg, you know, mm-hmm. that is against the official apology of the official sort of, you know, propaganda of authorities. Mm-hmm. And it becomes immediately subversive. Yeah. No, we don't recognize this kind of people, but you've seen this person, you know, you've met this person. How you are not sort of, you know.
And is there a sort of industry for writers writing kind of nationalist realism, for want of a better word, that is very much the approved culture? I mean,
yes, there are different types of literatures. Some people, for example, write the approved literature. Other people write mythological, let's say, literature.
Yeah? But that feels dangerous because you'll always think, oh, that this is just an analogy or a sort of parable of something that we could read onto. This is clearly critical of the government.
Yes, but sometimes it sort of passes, you know. For example, for the tradition, let's say, or for traditional literature, if you want to write about the urge for liberties, you write parable about the wind, you know, wind is free, you know, wind is everywhere, or about, I don't know, an eagle, yeah, eagle is flying everywhere, so one day I get out of the life of an eagle, you know. So sometimes, you know, it's read as a sort of, you know, promotion of national traditions, of national literature, of national way of thinking.
I mean, in a perverse way, that is one of the powers, I think, of literature, is that ability to use metaphor and to create parables. And I mean, in terms of the day-to-day life, imagine the constrictions of an authoritarian regime are not so good. But in terms of the approach to writing literature that is kind of constrained within using metaphor and parable, that it can create some interesting...
Yes, no, it can create, but the problem here, the deepest problem is that the Soviet literature or post-Soviet literature is fed up with these parables, because during the Soviet time, everyone was writing parables, you know, because everything was written between the lines, yeah, and everyone was guessing what the author means. Oh, he means the freedom, you know, he means this and that. So everything was written in a parabolic way, yeah, and therefore the literature is fed up with that one. Therefore, it seems, you know, secondhand.
Yeah.
Why, for example, Svetlana Alexievich wrote this book Secondhand Time, yeah? Because everything seems secondhand, you know, in this sort of, you know, application of the same techniques to the new time.
And do you think there is a modern way of approaching the parable? I think so.
But the parable shouldn't hide the reality.
No, no.
It should explore the reality. Yeah. Sometimes what I discover with the Uzbek literature, parable is hiding the reality.
Yeah. And if it's a writer who's wanting to write social realism but is forced to write parable, it's different than a writer whose natural instinct is to write a parable, because the a kind of parabolistic type of literature is doing something different than you know, a social realist novel.
Absolutely.
I imagine in Soviet times a lot of writers, their urge was to write a 600 page
social realism. Yeah,
but they were forced to write a parable about an ego instead of writing about poverty or...
It's about striking right balance, you know? Yes, you're absolutely right. A parable, if it serves, for example, to explore something, to disclose something, it's fine, you know? Rather than hiding and taking over everything else, parable for the sake of parable.
Would it be dangerous for someone to have, I mean, dangerous in greater or less extent, for someone to have a copy of one of your books in Uzbekistan, or is it not quite like that?
I've got the anecdotes, you know, when, for example, my foreign friends, for example, you know, they've got friends in Uzbekistan, and they offer them my books, so people are refusing.
So they are aware that it's sort of prohibited.
Because you were saying
that when you were turned away at the airport, I thought maybe it's just the case that the distributors never seem to buy any copies, and no one really knows why. But there is a kind of blacklist.
I think so. Especially the industry is aware.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there was a huge discussion about the Devil's Dance, yeah, and on the Facebook, because I published on the Facebook, and then it went viral on the Facebook, so people were reposting chapter by chapter. And then there was a discussion, and one person asked, you know, the publisher, why you don't publish the book? It's not against, it's traditional, it's about our iconic writer, you know, it's a great book, why you don't publish? And the publisher said, you have to have a huge heart to publish. We would love to publish everything of Ismailov, but you have to have a huge heart for that. I mean, be brave, basically. Mm-hmm. Nobody allows. One day, he said.
Yeah. I mean, so people take risks, don't they? I mean, it's very difficult for us in this country to maybe
but
think
I
about
I must say the people, really. You know, the people took risk. When President Karimov died, he died on the 29th of August, 2016, I think, and his death was announced on the 2nd of September. On the 5th of September, my book, The Devil's Dance, was sent without any consent from my side by, you know, by one publisher to the print on the 5th of September, using the sort of, you know, the time when...
You've got to make hay just at that point,
And they published 1,000 copies of the book. And that was the publisher who said, you have to have a huge, you know, because he wants to republish, because it immediately sort of, you know, was sold out, He wants to republish it, but unfortunately, you know...
Not quick enough. And is it, again, this is my ignorance, which I apologize for, but I know a little bit about some of the other Central Asian states and the kind of cult of personality they have around the leadership. So was that a similar... Did just another leader come in who was had just as strong a grip on everything? Or was there any sort of liberalization that...
There is window dressing, as usual. But what I discovered analyzing the leaders in our part of the world, you know, all of them, despite of their background, despite of their education, despite of their sort of, you know, which strata of society they are coming from, when they got the power, they're acting in the similar manner, in the similar manner, because... there is no accountability, you know, there is no civic society, there are no democratic institutions, and unfortunately, they're acting in the similar manner, you know, they're consolidating their power, they're getting rid of their opposition, they're making, their families are making huge sums of money, etc., etc.
I don't think that's only in Central Asia, if you look at what's happening in
everywhere,
the US.
Yeah, everywhere. Well. But luckily, you know, luckily... Here in the West, we've got the you know, the check and balances, you know? I always, I don't know, should I say that or not? I was seeing, for example, living and witnessing in this country how, for example, one prime minister was clinging to power for years and years and years, you know, though promised to give the power in 4 years' time to another one, you see? But the checks and balances are working here, whereas in our part of the world, they are not working.
Yeah. I know a lot of writers listen to the podcast. I like, we've not really talked about speaking into the computer, like the voice recognition. I don't know if you're able to say what software you use, or if, on a practical note, if you've tried different...
Yeah, because my writing is either in Russian or Uzbek. So for Russian, for example, speechpad.ru. It has got the English functionality as well.
Do you find it quite reliable? Because this, I've tried dictating to a computer and I just got frustrated with how
87-90% which is in the range of my sort of perfection.
I guess as you're wanting to edit it anyway, you're going back over it to check the tonality. It's not something you need to do quickly.
But it helps you once again to look more attentively, you know, to your text.
And that software just, I'd not really thought that you need different software for different languages. Yes. But that does Russian and Uzbek or...
English as well.
English as well.
Yeah, English as well,
Quite. That could be very useful. I like the idea of a computer being able to take dictation well, but as I said, although this is quite a few years ago that I tried it.
I've only ever tried for a few minutes, and it's similar, not really worked. But I think we've not really spoken to anyone that has that your approach. I think it's
no, it saved me quite a lot of money as well to end this discussion on a positive note, you know, because I used to spend quite a lot of money for the typist, you know, because you can hardly find a typist here who types for Uzbek, for example. Or my handwriting is so minute, you know, so you have to have lots of attention and lots of hard work, you know, to understand what I'm writing.
Oh, yeah, that's the only thing you think about that, if you're typing from someone else's handwriting. Yes.
And I guess that loses the whole link that you were saying, the tonality of reading it out. You're just sending away a piece of paper and getting another piece of paper back, or a disc back.
But,
I wonder if that software works, but I'm just thinking about this. One of the things that people always say about Russian is that they don't really have regional accents in Russian. It's quite a sort of standard Moscow Russian that people tend to speak. I don't know if you would agree with that or not. But maybe it's having a tiny bit of an accent in speaking into something that's maybe been designed for American English, maybe, or something.
I'm sure that's, I don't know. It's years since I've tried one as well.
This is the thing. It's about... It's 10 years ago that I tried. I'm sure the technology has come on a lot.
Yes, I think so. I mean, speechpad.ru is, even in English, for example, I found quite accurate, you know. 87, 90% maybe.
Okay. Thank you for listening, and thank you to Hamid Ismailov for joining us. Hamid's work, this is a couple of his titles, are available in the UK on Tilted Axis Press, possibly not in Uzbekistan.
You can find us at unsignedmethods.co.uk or on Twitter at unsignedmethods. Do drop by and give us your thoughts, comments.
Yeah, please, we'd love to hear from you. You can find out more about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com, at jamiebatchin on Twitter, or at jamie_batchin on Instagram.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next month.